sound, light, vibration, color. Okay, let's see what he has to say. The word of power of the soul trying to communicate. And so the word work starts. Remember, this, the soul is the light magician. This word is dual. It's like a dual chord. It's soul and personality. The chord of two notes is the producer of resulting effects, and is more important than the set phrase composing the word of power. That's a very technical little hint. If we just knew the right notes, it would be more important even than what is said. Probably for every, how many words of power can there be? Well, we know there are seven, right? Seven words of power. High search effect, the highest light controls, purpose itself and I, two merge with one, three minds unite, the highest light controls, so that I see the greatest light and the highest light controls, and then the highest and the lowest need.
Is there a reference for that?
Sure. There is a reference in the rays and initiations. Probably the highest light. Okay, so basically this is found on page 518 and 517.
Rays and
initiations. Somewhere there's the whole list. But
right.
But there are other words of power as well, and in a way, anything that the soul wants you to do is a kind of word of power. Mm-hmm. And what we've been trying to do is listen to what the soul wants us to do. You know, something's trying to get through. We are a piece of magical work ourselves. Yes, 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 yes. Oh, I just love talking. Yes, okay. So you know, every one of us has a little piece of the plan to carry out, and the soul is trying to impress us with this, if we're still enough to listen and we hear the still small voice. Now, is every little bit of that plan a word of power, or accompanied by an appropriate ray word? Because every little bit of the plan functions along this particular ray, so maybe the ray word of power is used. On the other hand, there is a note, and the note is very important. Yes.
So are we saying that in this instance the note comes before the light?
The note is more important than the actual phrase composing the word of power, is what he says. So there will be a note sounded. Maybe the word of power is sounded on a note.
Mm-hmm.
That's how appropriate.
Yeah. Also, there is a note.
I do that all the time, but I'm sounding it. Well, not all the time, but if I have the I see the greatest light, I choose the note G, and I intone, I see the greatest light, I'm the note G, only I don't say I'm the note G, I just say I see the greatest light. It'd be fun to do, wouldn't it? Oh yeah, that's fun to do. Yes, it is. Well, in the new schools, yes. I know, I'm just like a broken record when it comes to that. But I just do try to... Propaganda. Propaganda is very important. Now, I know that some of you have friends. So I would strongly suggest that you advise your friends of our enterprise and to tell them their chances are rapidly fading, but if they join us before December 21st, a new light will open. What is that?
20% discount. 20%?
Hey, for you, I'm going 35, you know? And I'll throw in three teas and a bag of balls.
Now we're talking.
Yeah, okay. Herein lies the problem. To sound these two notes synchronously and with the mind focused, that's interesting. I wonder if the new method of using overtone singing is involved. It really makes me wonder. Is overtone singing involved? You know, I can get a fifth. Let's try that. Some of you are overtone singers. Well, you do all kinds of funny things, but first of all, you sound like a dead cat. Start off by thinking you're a dead cat. At the same time. Well, you know, it takes a little while. Keith can teach you. Yes, he's super. And you have to do different things. And but basically, of course, you know, the ones that are really good at it can do amazing things. I was in the first time I ever heard this kind of singing, I was in the Agni Yoga Museum in New York. I was talking to Daniel Henton, and all of a sudden I hear this sound that I've never heard before, you know, and I just followed it, and I found a Russian emigre doing this. After that, he had a choir that we were all members of, you know, we all joined him in a choir, but he was fantastic. The little note that he could sing just went all through the museum. It was just so utterly pure what he could do. Nikolai was his name. He was actually a bass in his speaking, but he could produce all these high notes.
Have you ever heard of David Pike?
Yes.
He was at a conference with the Dalai Lama. Just a real quick digression.
Yes.
We got right next to them. They're only about a 10-foot platform.
Yes.
In the States, and we got right beside them. And when he and his six or seven cohorts
started to,
it was as though there was a separate entity about 30 feet above them.
Yes, exactly. Kudiki tells us about a new method of singing that will not rely upon the solar plexus. In other words, he talks about most operatic singing now, and it has got too much solar plexus emphasis, and he talks about the new method emerging. Anyway, we're talking, you know, to sound the two notes synchronously. Now, you know, unfortunately, not all notes are easily found in the overtone series. And, you know, if you have to sound a second or a seventh, it probably can be done, but not easily. Herein lies the clue to the significance of the AUM or the OM. In the early stage, well, and the AUM pertains to the personality and the OM pertains to the soul. Okay? I'll put that in. AUM, so AUM to personality and OM to the soul. Okay. In the early stages of the meditation work, the word is sounded audibly, whilst later it is sounded inaudibly. He says it's much more powerful to sound things inaudibly. That doesn't mean you don't hear anything. You know what I mean? I mean, in other words, you say, well, it's total silence, I'm sounding inaudibly. No, you will hear the note internally. This training in the sound of the AUM is an unconscious preparation for the dual work of spiritual creation. The facility comes as the attentive aspirant accustoms himself to hear within his brain the soundless sound of the OM. Well, I guess we just have to attempt that, you know.
After what?
I mean, we have to work with that, you know, try to make it, try to understand.
Yeah,
yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you just said that it, you know, that it's a sound.
Yeah. Well, just practice it yourself. Just
you say it's soundless.
Well, it's soundless in the outer sense.
Right.
In other words, I'm going to sound this note now. Oh, so I'm hearing the note after I've stopped singing the note. It's in my imagination. You can do that, right? Can you go from om to oh, you know? In other words, it just continues in your imagination. Right. But he may be talking about something else which you don't generate. Maybe you'll hear something like that, but you're not responsible for necessarily thinking it. See, that's the auditory imagination. But in order to, I often tell people who have trouble visualizing, I say, well, just remember what you saw. You know, just I close my eyes and now I can see what I just saw.
You can develop by habituation that practice by saying it outwardly and then begin to teach your memory to remember.
You would know how it sounded more or less, but then the real cherry on the cake would be if you don't generate it and you hear the sound. See?
Mm-hmm.
The sound comes like right before Alice Bailey used to receive dictation from the Tibetan, she heard the sound in her ear. Now, it's getting so I carry a pitch pipe to find out what sounds I'm hearing in my ear. You know, sometimes you get that ringing sound in your ear, you know?
Dwayne
used to?
Yeah, he's always being real close attention to the sound.
Yeah, okay. So, but if you carry your pitch pipe, you'll find out if there's a particular pitch on which sounds tend to occur. But, you know, you don't know unless you document them.
It used to say that if you hear a sound ringing in your left ear,
mm-hmm.
you want to block it.
Oh, because it's the bad angel and it's the good angel. And I don't know, I can't, you know, some people think it's tinnitus, you know, they...
Tinnitus.
How do they call it?
Tinnitus.
Tinnitus?
Yes.
T-I-N-N-I-T-U-S.
Right.
I have to say something as a trained medium. One of the things that was pointed out to me was that if you hear a constant ringing in your ear, it's often the fact that spirit wants your attention. So you have to ask. For this group, I would say you could do your align with your soul and then ask the soul if it's appropriate for you to interact with whatever entity wants your attention. It could be that your soul wants your attention. I had the case of a friend of mine who has had severe tinnitus for some time, and I told her about this, and she says, oh, that's just, you know, see who it is. See who's ringing your doorbell.
Who's that knocking your doorbell?
And so she found out it was her mother wanting to pass a message on to her.
Ah, did her tinnitus...
She didn't have a problem.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
Isn't there a place where he talks about the different sounds coming from maybe one's the soul, one's the master, whatever?
Someone. The notes. Yeah. Mm. The notes, indeed. Anyway, to get some idea of what the soundless sound might sound like, just practice turning off the vocal sound and continuing to hear it. And that might give us some. Because every one of these high ringing notes in the ear, it has a pitch, and that pitch is not accidental. So we want to find out, but of course you have to carry your pitch pipe with you, either that or have perfect pitch. Okay. I would suggest here that students accustom themselves to work in this manner, sounding the word audibly and with much frequency. At the close of the morning meditation with much frequency, but emphasizing in the early part that close attention to the inaudible hearing, which will develop the sensitivity of the inner ear, the etheric ear. It sounds like in the early part of the meditation, being more attentive to the silent word. Later, when the personal note or sound is established, and the inner sound is sensed, there can be definite practice in blending the two. Wow. That's kind of attuning them. I'm sorry, what?
What? It's reflecting so much for
us. Yeah, okay.
Well, I try to read.
Oh, you're trying to read. Oh, okay. Got it. Okay. But you have that, though. You have all this. Okay. Later, when the personal note or sound is established and the inner sound is sensed, there can be a definite practice in blending the two. I suppose by an interactive attunement. You know, it'd be interesting to hear both of these sounds simultaneously, and then you would be sure that there was the presence of these two factors. Inner of a tree. Right, I know it's difficult to see that, right. This entails the closest attention and the power to perform two activities simultaneously with the mental attitude of attention to both. So there's the mind and two notes. It's kind of a... Wait a second, is this working? I seem to have lost my... Oh, here it is. The triangle. Right. So the mind... Sorry. And two notes. A triangle. TRL. Students whose aspiration is keen and clear would do well to face the issue where the magical work is concerned. Now he's going to ask us some soul-searching questions. Study their aptitude in meditation and their willingness to proceed with stability and caution with the needed discipline. To proceed with stability and caution with the needed discipline. So we're going to question ourselves now. Our aptitude, our stability, our caution. To face this, I would suggest that any who are deeply concerned in the work should study and answer the following questions in the light of their soul. So why don't we take a meditative attitude towards this for a minute and see what, you know, align with the soul light. And let's ask ourselves the following questions as he asks us to do. Do you feel you have reached the stage wherein you can A. eliminate the meditation form as you now have it or B. enter with relative facility into the state of contemplation, or C. recognize the vibration of your own soul? So let's ponder those points for a minute. Can we eliminate our meditation form as we now have it? Can we enter with relative facility into the state of contemplation? We remember what that was all about. Slipping out of our own meditation and into the meditation of the soul. Do we think we can recognize the vibration of our own soul? then he asks, does the sacred word mean anything to you? And could you formulate clearly the reason you sound it? And then the third question he asks, are you anxious to proceed in this work because your personality aspires, or because your soul is beginning consciously to utilize its mechanism? Are you anxious to proceed in this work because your personality aspires, or because your soul is beginning consciously to utilize its mechanism? Reflection of the note we have sounded. In connection with this last question, he says, a close analysis is called for, and I conjure you to speak truth to yourself and thus clearly ascertain the true position. And this is your own business. It's a question that lies between a man's soul and himself, but surely I'm sure we all see ways that we could more completely fulfill the implications of these questions. The sacred word can always mean more, and the soul could always be more compelling. But out of so many different vibrations that it's possible to sense, we have to select out and discriminate the vibration of our own soul. And he does talk about the different vibrations, your soul ray group, your master, you know. There are just about seven or eight things there that he lists, and all of them have to be discriminated. So, you know, just the way of like an inner attentiveness with the ear, there's an inner type of sensitivity that you suspend and you you hold it in suspension. You kind of are not only listening, but you're awaiting a touch as well. A touch and a sound, and maybe awaiting a vision also. It's a stage of alertness, let us just say. Now here I cut some things that were here, no doubt they're important, but to resume our consideration of the AUM, the sound of the sacred word, when correctly used, has various effects which might be touched upon here. So he did ask us, do we know why we're sounding the Om? Now, you know, we could say what? What are a couple of things we could say as to why we sound the Om? Well, I'm not sure yet, but I know we'll arrive. We're certainly somewhere.
128.
And where did we leave off?
Number 3, page 128.
The question lies between the man's soul and himself, which is whatever page that was. That was middle of 128, and then I skipped some.
Yeah.
And I skipped some. Okay. So yeah, he interpolates some remarks about himself here. And they're interesting, but I think we have to stick to the point. And then to resume our consideration of the AUM, that would be somewhere else. And that would be on, whoa, 140. Well, we skipped quite a bit. That's okay. I think I'm frozen. Okay, I'm not quite frozen. 140. 140, yeah. I think there's something happening with my mouse here. It may need charging or something. Okay. Okay. To resume our consideration of the AUM. The sound or the sacred word, when correctly used, has various effects which might be touched upon here. Well, we know there's purification, we know there's the geometry involved, we know there's expulsion. It has an effect very much like the Kundalini. We know that there's a centering in the soul space, there's a quieting of other vibrations and the bringing of the soul vibration into a closer attention. The Om sounded forth with intent thought behind it acts as a disturber, a loosener of the coarse matter of the body of thought, of emotion, and physical body. So it's operative on all levels, which is, I think, important. Every aspect of our personality can experience the effect. Operative on all levels. With thought behind it, not just mindlessly. You know, it's... Master M talks about mindless repetition. We have to have our attention with... He says it's like taking vitamins. If you take them with consciousness, they'll really work. If you take vitamins without consciousness, the effect is much less. So it's not just a question of popping them in your mouth. You're actually thinking of what you're doing, why you're doing it. When sounded forth with intense spiritual aspiration behind it, it acts as an attractive medium and gathers in particles of pure matter to fill the places of those earlier thrown out. So the first thing we do is we find, if we put intent thought behind the sound. So intense aspiration attracts the matter, and intent thought expels it. That's an interesting distinction. And I never really made that distinction. I didn't think of the two methods. Intent thought to disturb and intense aspiration to magnetically draw in the better matter. Okay. Students should strive to have these two activities in their minds. as they use the word in their meditation, the utilization of the word is of practical value and results in the building of good bodies for the use of the soul. Well, that's really right there, isn't it?
Do you think that what he said earlier about the two sounds at once has something to do with doing these things simultaneously?
Yeah, maybe the two sounds at once are the sound of your personality and the sound of your soul. I think it's an attunement exercise, a harmonizing exercise. I'm not sure it's a purification exercise per se. I think it's an integration exercise. So let's see, hearing and adjusting the two notes, one of the personality and the other of the soul, is an exercise in attunement and integration. But maybe we could find other ways in which there was a relation to what it's saying now. Maybe, you know, it's possible to sound those two notes on the om. You see, we could say that. What if we manage to sound the two notes as if on the om? Maybe then it will be not only attunement integration, but purification as well. Maybe it will adjust other matter in our systems to respond to those two notes. Because right now, there's much within us that doesn't respond to our soul note very well. Maybe more of our matter could be attuned accordingly. The use of the om serves also to indicate to the workers on the universal planes and to those in the outer world who are gifted with spiritual perception, that a disciple is available for work and can be utilized actively in the needed places of earth. We signal that we are ready. So probably we don't find the brothers of the other side using the om a whole lot. Probably the AUM or some other word they would use. He does tell us to watch out for amen. He says, don't use amen. Yeah, he says, use om, not amen. He's specific about it. He says it's a materialistic word which sets the seal upon a materialistic project. These are my own words, but he uses his own words here. He says, refrain from it, and it will gradually die out. Amen. Yeah, it was. This should be borne in mind by all aspirants and should serve as an incentive in making the outer phenomenal life coincide with the inner spiritual impulse. Okay. Well, I think we do want to signal our availability for work, and I'm sure we all use the om many times a day in different contexts. When we're... I'm sure. Yeah.
When I get on my bicycle and start pedaling, I do an om in the initial stages to,
keep body and soul together.
Keep all together.
Yeah.
And keep the mind's variety of motions in front of me.
It's a good idea. Experience does help, doesn't it? Okay. The use of the sacred word has its place also in the magical work of hierarchy. By the way, there's another great section in Letters on Occult Meditation on the sacred word.
Yeah.
It's profound.
It's in our ways of initiations.
Also, yes.
Where he takes it all, like dropping the M
before
the M, because the M is more...
Matter. You left. You start out with a big O-M, then you go to an O with a small M, then you finally go to an O with a point. That's all that's left. Matter has become a point. And the personality does not loom very large. So, in a way, it means the toning down of that particular sound. Thought forms are created for the embodiment of ideas, and these embodied forms are sent forth to contact the minds of disciples who are responsible to the group of a master for carrying forward the plan. So, they use the om to do this. Through the cultivated receptivity of the developed and controlled mental body, aspirants become aware of ideas which the masters bring through from the plane of the universal mind. Let's just say Atma, you know, something of that nature. And hence are in a position to cooperate intelligently. So here we're talking about mental receptivity. And I'm sure the Om helps this. It helps purify every vehicle and render it more functional. Okay. Although elsewhere, DK tells us it's not the true word. In a way, it's a symbolic word. So we begin to wonder what the true word actually is. They, in their turn, as this rule seeks to indicate, create thought forms of those received ideas. Ideas first, then the forms that follow, and utilize them in their groups for the helping of the world. The main work of a disciple on the mental plane is to train himself to do four things. So let's see how this works. We're all dealing with sound, right? Sound, light, vibration, and the form. So this is the section on sound. To be receptive to the mind of the master. This does not mean to be receptive in your astral body to the image of the master. There's a difference, right? And so, you know, maybe 95% of what goes on the internet now in the channeled books or even more is receptivity to the astral forms of the master. To cultivate a right intuitive understanding of the thoughts sent him by the master. To receive is one thing, to understand is another. To embody the ideas received in such form as will be suitable for those he is engaged in helping. So not only do you understand, but you repackage, you reformulate, so that you can actually, you adapt to help those in your immediate environment. You know, I'm sure that when you talk to the people that you want to influence, you don't necessarily quote verbatim from the book. Probably there are other forms of words that you may find yourself using. Suppose you have to translate it to a different philosophical point of view. Suppose you want to take it to the Christian audience, let's just say. Do we necessarily, or the Jewish audience for that matter? It's not necessarily word for word, is it? We use other methods of explanation. Through sound, light, and vibration, to make his thought form active, now this is the whole point of this rule. Through sound, light, and vibration, to make his thought form active, embodying as much of the universal thought as is desirable, so that other minds may contact it. Now, when he uses the word universal, I think by universal, we should think cosmic ethers. In other words, the living part of the cosmic physical plane. When it steps up into the cosmic ethers, we have entered the realm in which the Soto Logos is expressing. The Soto Logos is the God of our particular little universe. It's not the whole thing by any means. DK uses the word universal in that context often. So this last one is what we want to do the most and the best. This is what the rule is all about. Thus are groups gathered, organized, taught, and lifted, and thus the hierarchy of adepts can reach the world. So can we fulfill these things? The very first thing is to be receptive to the mind of the master. That is a kind of, what would you call this? Spiritual telepathy? And then if we receive something, you know, we oftentimes, I think we're receiving a lot from the books. Are we actually receiving it directly from the master or from his ashram? Well, there may be moments. And if we receive something, do we really understand it? Can we adapt it? And can we render a thought form vibrant enough to have its own life and perpetuity so others can contact it? So we're given here some things we have to do. Yeah.
I think that's a good thought about whether we're receiving something from the books. And I think it may be that we don't necessarily contact the ashram or contact the master because we've read about the masters, we've read about the ashram. It may be that because we are in contact with the ashram, with the master, we find the books. And
That's one way.
This resonance that reflects itself in our life and it brings those opportunities, contacts, books, teachers, whatever, which is a reflection of what's happening in our own life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because we are in contact already even unconsciously with the ashram, we may be led to the books. That's one way. And another thing that I've sometimes seen is that the books say one thing, and then another thought that is not in the books is prompted. And this kind of thought, you realize, is not just a vague association, it's a flash, it's an intuitive flash, that actually exists as a truth and is implicit in what is written in the books. So is the master speaking in that way? Well, it's part of the thought for which he is responsible. Of course, a lot of this requires that we kind of know what ashram we're gravitating towards. Because, we're told in Rule 9 that the disciple merge himself in the circle of his other selves. Let but one color blend them and their unity appear. Only when the group is known and sensed can energy be wisely emanated. So we may be on the wrong stream. On the other hand, sometimes we're on loan to another ashram for a time in order to pick up certain qualities and to enrich that ashram with our own qualities. But this is all to say it helps to know what you're doing and to go to the right place. One of the Tibetan students, who was, I think, a first-rate monad, but a little bit eager on the trigger, had driven himself to the edge of Master Moria's ashram prematurely and had to kind of turn back from the door for a while he learned certain second-ray he was a Gemini with Leo rising. And with the moon in Taurus, it's amazing how many of those people have the moon in Taurus. Sometimes
moon in Taurus,
how many of them, those advanced disciples?
They
had the moon in Taurus. Yeah, this particular.
Yeah, but then Simon Sagittarius was affecting him.
Maybe. Well, Leo was right there too. He had Leo rising. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it'd be fun to kind of study the astrology of some of these more advanced disciples. Almost everyone in the primary group, the original group, sort of around Alice Bailey, the number of moons in Taurus was just out of proportion to the numbers. Foster Bailey had moon in Taurus, Regina Keller moon in Taurus, William Miller had the moon in Taurus, Eugene Cosgrove had the moon in Taurus. These are people who...
And what does that mean for you going to...
Well, you know, usually... The moon in Taurus is a good place for the moon if you want to embody form, but it's also a place where you find that the whole instinctual nature is standing against you because it doesn't want to do what you want it to do, and it's very happy doing what it does. So there's a certain stubbornness of the instinctual nature, and you've got to get it moving, you know. Anyone can attest to this?
We got Taurus with high aspiration yesterday?
Yeah, but yes, I did. But it's true, the highest form of aspirational idealism is found in Taurus, and the question is whether the moon position could give that to you. Maybe it could. Maybe it could. They were certainly bent to find the light. They wanted the light. So I'll have to do some kind of analysis of that, how many of them had it, but I was just shocked that so many of the powerful disciples had that moon in Taurus. The ones that were near the third degree, you know, they were being trained in a certain manner, and they had that. And it caused them a lot of trouble, too. You know, they had difficulty with their lunar nature, and it's entrenched qualities.
The ashna development and how it is. Taurus rushes blindly before the
Sagittarius. Direct. Yeah, yeah. They're both visual signs, very, very much so. Anyway, sound, light, and vibration, he creates this. And so, you know, are you really. Oh, wait a second. Something's wrong here. Your battery is low. That must mean that something below here is not working. It's always nice when they tell you your battery is low.
Yeah, rather than just turn it off.
Yeah. Let's see. That's not it. And this is it. Is this it?
Oh, it's some like some there to there.
Now, this is an intelligence test.
Ah. Yeah, you're coming.
Well done.
There we go.
All right. Well done.
I wonder if that's related to what you were having a problem announced earlier.
Yeah, I don't know. This one is...
We had a weak
connection. Well, a lot of us have a weak connection. DK told his group that he had expected more of them. He gave them two pretty powerful meditations to begin their discipleship work together, and then he had to revert to giving them an alignment exercise because he discovered their alignment was weak. And it was a very powerful exercise. It really took them from the base of the spine to the monad. So, you know, they accomplished much, I'm sure. How do you feel? Do you feel your alignment is strong or consistently strong? Or
where is that alignment?
What is it what?
Where is that alignment?
Where is the alignment?
What is the exercise again?
Oh, I'm not telling. But if you're really industrious and you look through the first, she already knows. I'll give you a hint. This is the meditation three is the alignment. Okay,
yeah,
that's the first hint. The second hint is that meditation four is found around page 140. Now, using the power of deduction. And trusting that he put things in order, I think we'll find out. Anyway, he found as a pretty general condition among his students that their alignment was weak. So we can question ourselves.
But that was a surprise to him? Would he have not known that just by...
It was weaker than he had anticipated, or at least they demonstrated it in using meditations 1 and 2, that it was weaker than it should have been in using those meditations.
He would not have seen that prior to that?
Well, he probably saw it, but you know, you're just attempting to see what people can do, and you make an experiment, they don't do it, and you say, you need this. So, and I'll bet there may be some of us who need it too. This is my intuition on the matter. Because probably we are not so very different from those students who were working with him in those days. We may be better informed in some ways and maybe less aspirational. I mean, they were highly, highly motivated. Now, the question is, what is the depth of our aspiration and the depth of our continuity and so forth? Would we fail or succeed if we were presented with the same opportunity? We're not going to find that out right now. But we will. We'll be presented with opportunity, all right. And hopefully we learn from what happened. There are groups gathered, organized, taught, and lifted, and thus the hierarchy can reach the world. Thus are the groups gathered. There are many other uses of the Om, of course, but if the students will ponder on these three, they will make it possible for further uses to be imparted. So what were the three uses of the Om?
To show that one is available for...
That's one of it.
Clearing out and
pulling in. And signaling the availability and also in the creation of thought forms, either by the hierarchy or by man himself, right? Okay. Those are the three. Okay. May I add that the sound is only truly potent when the disciple has learned to subordinate the lesser sounds. So that links us to the idea of detachment, doesn't it? It links us to the idea of removing our attention from lower fields and not energizing them, so all the modifications of those fields are coming up in our face when we're sounding this off. So in other words, this is linked to the idea of, whoopsie, to the idea of tranquilizing the vehicles. He uses that term, doesn't he? Only as the sounds he sends forth normally into the three worlds are reduced in volume. Loud voices, let's see, how does it say, and the sound, see, loud something, a loud noise and the sound of many voices from outside the darkened chamber where the weaver sits. They're going to crash in on him, and they're going to disturb him and reveal the ugliness of the carpet he has been weaving. So we have to render quieted in volume and activity the sounds we normally send forth. How do we do that? Do we talk more quietly?
Simplification of the life.
Give for the sound to be heard and so accomplish its purpose. Okay, through simplification, that's one of the ways, because there's a lot less activity of an unnecessary kind. Okay, reduced in volume. And of course, it may also be that we watch the tones of our voice more carefully. And we try to be less raucous, perhaps, except at parties where, you know, it's appropriate. Reduction of quantity too. That's interesting. So, if suppose we decide to speak purposefully, how would that be? Good, and not idly. In other words, reduce the idle words. If we reduce idle words, what percentage of our conversation would be reduced? I'm just thinking here. You know. Hi, how you doing? How's the weather? Good.
How about them Yankees?
Yeah, how about them? Well, you know, words off the subject. He does tell us that when we're approaching initiation, that the words are well chosen and to the point. On the other hand, he says, don't think you'll be initiated by not talking. It's a bit like being initiated because you don't eat meat, you know, so what about the horse and the elephant? You know, they're vegetarians too, but they're not there. So an elephant should be a real initiate. Well, maybe he is. He's the top of the line, you know, of his type. So it's not by refraining from all speech, but it's by the wise, judicious choice of speech. What a discipline, huh? I mean, to think before you speak. It almost involves the fifth ray, I've noticed.
And it's also giving more attention to the silence.
Exactly.
Speaking less, there's more opportunity to just dwell.
There's more space for receptivity?
Right.
Yes? Okay. Okay. Only as the multitude of spoken words is reduced and silence in speech is cultivated. Well, it's kind of interesting. Silence in speech. Is he talking about intervals, perhaps? Interludes? Or a quality in the speech? A spaciousness in the speech, possibly. Okay.
I think it's the center of from where one speaks.
And the center, which is active or focused when one speaks. Would it be possible for the word to make its power felt on the physical plane? So, you know, the many sounds and the one sound. I talked about that magician who was dismissed because of the many sounds and not tuning in with the one sound. Will it be possible for the word to make its power felt on the physical plane? Only when the many voices of the lower nature and of our environment are silenced will the voice that speaketh in the stillness make its presence felt, and that is called the voice of the silence. Only when the many sounds of the many waters die away in the adjustment of the emotions will the clear note of God, the God of the waters, be heard. Now, you know, very interesting about Neptune, God of the waters. is a planet of silence, as is Pisces, the sign of silence. You know, the conversational abilities of the fish are less than those of the monkey or the parrot. You know, it's an intuitive sign. Although there are many loquacious Pisceans still, they are known for their love of silence and the sensitivity to loud noises and that sort of thing. Are you sensitive to loud noises? No. Just wondering.
Maybe Hall was a Pisces, wasn't he?
He was. Was he that way? Yes, he had the Sag on the ascendant. He had a point to make.
Funny how the mammals in the ocean, speak to communicate.
Those are the mammals.
Yeah.
Those are the mammals.
That's true.
Fish are a little quieter. Yeah, they haven't found their voice yet.
There is something else much more interesting about the voice. Have you seen these documentaries where they have been following the waves and how their sing or song is changing? And they are, yes, it is changing. So it's some kind of that one would be thinking, yeah, one can think many ways. Are they singing alarm? Or is it something because the mother teaches that song to the baby, and the baby starts to sing the same way, so that the priest, how do you call them, herds? The herds, when they have been separating from the original, so they have developed their own songs around the planet.
In different places, different songs in different places.
I just saw one document. It was amazing. It was, believe me, it was so beautiful. It was done again majestically, where they are in these blue waters and they are singing these songs, mm-hmm. and they are going and diving deep into the sea, and you are just hearing the song. It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think that they keep some kind of, if we think about the sun, they have to keep something in energetic and vibrational level.
Mm.
And what do they see? What do they see? Yeah.
It will be revealed for us. Anyway, there's a contrast in the use of Neptune and the use of Mercury. Mercury is associated with all levels of the mind. It does have a Buddhic quality to it, but Neptune is totally Buddhic in its higher aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the contrast between the silence of immediate intuitive revelation and the many, many words of the mind if you're trying to arrive at that revelation. Sometimes the lightning of thought of Mercury will convey it, but oftentimes there is a contrast between, let us say, a square between Gemini and Pisces.
So, what
you know what I'm saying? Gemini is ruled by Mercury. It's the sign of many words.
Yeah.
And Pisces is, you know, archetypically the sign of the few words. It's ruled by Neptune. So, I'm just trying to convey this point about speech.
What is the planet that rules the average man?
In which
Earth.
The many, many forms, the many, many verbal forms which are generated by the average person in conversation. You've all seen an irresponsible throat center at work, haven't you? You know? Things that just on and on and on and on and on.
Is there Mercury in the throat?
Yes, I think Mercury should be associated with the throat. I think it is not given by the Tibetan that way, but since it rules Gemini and speech, it's the planet of speech, and since it is one of the planets associated with Taurus, in other words, the word for Mercury and the word for Buddha are the same. Mercury is Buddha. Buddha is Taurus. Taurus is the throat center. So I think that there is much value to considering Mercury in relation to the throat center and Taurus, giving the sounding forth of the tone. Gemini doesn't sound the tone, it gives you the intelligent modification of the tone. But Taurus sounds the notes, the great waves of sound that are very influential through the throat center. People seldom realize the potency of a word, yet it is stated, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. Word was God. Without Him was not anything that was made. When therefore we read these words, our minds go back to the dawn of the creative process when, through the medium of sound, God spoke and the worlds were made. God spoke. Now, which we know now, it's interesting. I sometimes think that Vishnu sings and Brahma speaks. There you have kind of the contrast between the relationship of tones and sounds coming out of the second ray, the great musical ray. We could say that ray 4 is the great musical ray, but from another point of view, ray 2 is the higher archetype of that. And Brahma is giving all of the intelligence of the many word forms. So the intelligence aspect of the many modifications comes with Brahma. You can sing something into existence, but when you want to start modifying everything, you need the intelligence. It has been said that the chief agency by which nature's wheel is moved in a phenomenal direction is sound. Meaning, if you want to create form, you do so through sound. Now, if you go to the monadic plane and you find seven large circles, those are seven sound forms on the monadic plane. In other words, every monad has its note, and that is the first plane of form, we are told. And the forms are the archetypal geometrical forms which are produced by certain sounds. So if you want to produce archetypal relational geometry, use sound. So our true home on the monadic plane are sound homes, geometrical homes generated by archetypal sound. For the original sound or word sets in vibration the matter of which all forms are made and initiates that activity which characterizes even the atom of substance. So what about Fohat? Do you think Fohat is making sound, or is that a sound is going forth as Fohat when the atom of substance is created on the atomic plane? Fohat and sound. I'll just leave it that, because I think sound is the great creator in all respects.
Michael, here he says the original sound or word sets in vibration.
The matter.
Does it sound like, does it seem like, if your sound does come before vibration?
Yes, that's the point. In this particular presentation, sound is primary.
But
in the other one?
I know.
Yes?
What do you think?
I can't quite solve that one. I just want to say that sound itself is a vibration.
Right.
Vibration seems primary,
yeah,
as far as I can see. It's the first movement.
Sound is a vibration.
Light is a vibration. Color is a vibration. You know, in other words, the common denominator seems to be vibration to me. And yet, the above vibration, what starts vibration going? What is that initial impact? The impact is caused by Vulcan. Vulcan is the ruler of Taurus that rules the throat. Taurus, sound, Vulcan, vibration.
Yeah.
That's one way to think of it.
Oh, I was just going to say that sound is related, of course, to the word. It's related to air, to booty, the initial impulse.
Sound as the initial impulse. Yeah. Well, and you know, before the sound, if you get rid of all air in your body, well, just try to go, just press yourself, then you try to sing a note, you know? Let's just say that unless your note can float on a current of air derived from the breath, it's not going to arise. So from a certain point of view, the breath comes first.
Yeah.
You see, every singer knows that you can... there's no real sound. Your vocal cords, the duality, have to close before you can generate sound. So the first aspect is considered to be related to the breath, and in this case the second aspect comes with sound. In this case, Vishnu, the singer. You know, They play catch with each other.
Yeah.
Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva are chasing each other's tails. You know, they're going around and around, and the way DK explains that is that Brahma and Vishnu are in Shiva, and that Shiva and Brahma are in Vishnu, and so forth it goes.
Yeah.
So there's really a ninefoldness here.
But in Atmic Plane, there is a correspondence to sound.
That very definitely, because it's the third, and it's ruled by Saturn.
Yes.
Aether there, but still so.
Anyway,
yeah.
There is the correspondence.
Yeah, because the Atmic Plane is the third, rules the throat center, which is the third center, and it relating to the third ray and the ear and the voice and all of that.
And it's related to sacral center because of the creation that Prana will bring forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what? The voice itself can be related to the first, second, and third ray.
Yeah.
Probably, you know, sound, light, and vibration. Is vibration related to the second ray? It is.
Yes.
Is it not? Absolutely, because of the oscillation. Is vibration related to the third ray? Yes, because it is the first activity. See what I mean? So you can find the first three aspects of divinity in all of these modes. You just have to keep the relativism going to understand how it works.
Could it be like the vibration is the Shiva, where one is in the mind, then Vishnu is singing, it's the sound, Prana says the word.
I think you can say some of that, definitely. That the singer is the second aspect. And the pronouncer of the word and all of its variety, is the Brahma aspect.
Yeah.
But the very power to do it is Shiva.
Yeah.
That which sustains the possibility. It is the breath. The breath is the vital current that keeps all of these things going. We're not unfamiliar with the idea that the breath is related to the first ray, are we?
No.
Yes.
The light apparently didn't emerge after the Big Bang for about 380,000 years. So there was the Big Bang and then a long period of opaqueness, and light finally emerged after quite a time.
Okay, that's an interesting statement. You know, I'm in touch with some people who fill me in on some of the things that are appearing in the subject, and he tells me that there's a group of scientists who's challenged the Big Bang now for different reasons.
What are they?
I don't know. I don't know the reasons, but they have their belief that it is not the only method of explaining the present universe. But occultism tells us that we have an oscillating universe, expanding and contracting. We have a breath, and with that, the Big Bang seems to fit. Even though it may be, a etheric physical bang. In other words, there may be different points of emergence on other planes. I know the scientists say it accounts for everything, but it seems to me an emergence on our lowest planes and not on all planes. And I think that's where the huge chronology of the occultist comes in. That the very outer universe may be of relatively short duration, but when you're talking about the inner parts of it, we may extend that duration a great deal. In other words, there may be a bang on the astral plane, a bang on the mental plane, and so forth. In other words, those points of emergence out of a point of potential. A point of emergence, point of potential, and making the entire plane. All of this is Fohat, I think, at work. Anyway, you know, trying to move on here. Sound creates phenomena. And we've all seen that, you know, we've seen those, what's the guy's name that, you know, that has all of the little particles and sound gives them formation.
Jenny?
In other words, he gives you a uniform medium of very responsive tiny particles, very fine, you know, uses different kinds, and he manages to submit them to a current of sound and watch the geometry take place. They,
yeah.
sound geometrizes.
When the Om is properly sounded in that way, the Shri Yantra is created.
I would love to see that happen.
I think there's a film of it. I've seen a still photograph from the film in a book I have on Yantra.
Right.
But I heard that when they somehow change that, translate that into electrical form, then it makes the yantra. But then when it is sounded in the water, it creates that 12-petaled image. I have those images here.
Uh-huh. Well, this is fascinating, but basically sound induces form.
Yeah.
This much we are quite convinced of, and we're aware that even by the words we speak, the forms that we create in the world appear. In other words, our relations with other people and our environment are often generated by the kinds of words we speak. I don't mean in any immediate magical manner. I just mean in the more mundane manner. In other words, if you're always, if you're always critical, disrespectful, abusive, blah blah blah, what kind of organization will you create around you? What will your relationships be? How will you be configured with other people? See, that's even in the non-magical sense. So form creates relationship, and it all goes up to the monadic plane. Those seven fundamental sound forms are the first forms to emerge out of the sea of life. Although I've often puzzled that Shambhala is described as a beautiful display of energy lines and forms, even. Somewhere, I don't know if we could find that. Shambhala defined, can I do that? Do I dare do it? I'm talking about not doing it while I'm doing it. This is a little bit of an ambiguity, you know.
But isn't it also the still place or the point of peace or whatever?
Well, it says that, but we don't know exactly what that means. It could be a standing wave. Point of, peace. Okay, so definition of, maybe that's it. No, that's not it. I want to just see if you see anything here about the beauty of it. Ah, here it is. No, it's right there. It is a world of pure energy, of light, and of directed force. It can be seen as streams and centers of force, all forming a pattern of consummate beauty, all potently invocative of the world of soul and of the world of phenomena. It therefore constitutes, in a very real sense, the world of causes and of initiation. And when they say all forming a pattern of consummate beauty, and I'm assuming by this that where the Lord of the world and even the Christ not can be found on the logoic plane, that's really the heart of Shambhala, So I'm saying, look, there are forms in Shambhala. Because you don't have a pattern of constant beauty unless you have form. That is form. So we are told that the first seven forms emerge on the monadic plane, and it is the first plane of form, and yet what is the kind of form we're dealing with here? Well, when we become seventh degree initiates, I guess we'll know. So, set your mind to it. I imagine it'll take a while.
Where's the program?
It's worthy. I would say, Christ was moving fast, and he managed it from the time he was, let's just say, maybe he achieved the fourth initiation 5,000 years ago as Sri Krishna. Now, of course, things have changed now, and there's different types of movement and speeds, but I would say you have to give yourself at least 5,000 years, something like that. From right now. Well, from the time you have achieved the fourth degree, and we all know that's imminent. So then we'll know about these patterns of consummate beauty in Shambhala, and also maybe they reflect Sanat Kumara's daily ritual.
Right.
Are behind that. We're told about, the sound and color breaking on the shores of the three worlds, and probably the archetype is in Shambhala. Anyway, I don't think of Shambhala as formless, nor do I think of the Sea of Fire as formless anymore. Sea of Fire has patterns of beauty, yes.
Second subplane of Eric?
Now let's take a look at that. Second subplane etheric is the subatomic ether, and it is basically the monadic plane. Right. So now what I am proposing is that because the Christ himself as the seventh degree initiate is focused on the logoic plane, that Sanat Kumara minimally, with the Buddhas of activity, is focused on the logoic plane. So I'm proposing that the Sea of Fire is not just an amorphous sea. I'm proposing that it has at least three major forms on it, whereas the monadic plane has seven major forms. But of course, yes, the second ether is a major, as far as we're concerned, because we are monads within our monadic vehicle, it is Shambhala for us. Although, if alchemy works correctly, it won't be Shambhala forever. We will make our way to the logoic plane at the seventh initiation. Okay, so hang in there. Okay.
It's going to be okay when we get there, right? It's going to be worth the work.
Man, it'll be heaven.
Heaven.
The seventh heaven, as a matter of fact. We're told that St. Paul's discussion about the third heaven, well, it has been misinterpreted because nobody understood it. It was something D.K. said, the third heaven as it reflects the seventh. So the seventh heaven is logoic plane with Sanat Kumara, priest of the order of Melchizedek. You see, St. Paul had entered the order of Melchizedek. Sanat Kumara's home, he's the priest and the main man there, and that was the logoic plane, the seventh heaven. So the third heaven, with its, what can we call it, the monastic permanent atom, on the highest point of the third heaven, reflects the seventh heaven. It's the archetypal for the whole causal body. The causal body is made out of that point on the third heaven.
Does that mean that he had entered a certain initiation?
Well, he was certainly the third degree, and he was realizing somehow that his home in the third heaven reflected the seventh heaven. And we all know that song, I'm in Heaven, don't we? Did you see the Long Mile, or the, how did it go, the Green Mile, or something like that?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. I'm in Heaven. Oh, that was quite good. Brilliant, just brilliant. All right. Moving right along. The literature and the scriptures of the ancient nations and great religions bear testimony to the efficacy of sound in producing the tangible and the visible. I guess Joshua knew something about sound. It would change the wrecking business entirely. Okay, the Hindus say very beautifully that the great singer built the worlds, and the universe is his song. And this is a literal fact. And Pythagoras realized it too. Music is fundamental to the structure of the entire divine pattern. This is another way of expressing the same idea. If this is realized, and the science of this concept somewhat understood, the significance of our own words and utterances of sound and speech become almost a momentous happening. Now, probably, many of us say non-momentous things. When we wake up in the morning, we're going to probably let loose before the day is over, you know, thousands and thousands of words. And do we consider our utterances as momentous? Of moment. Of importance. And yet, with our utterances, we are shaping our entire future and all vehicles, our own and those around us. I see something. Okay, a little Virgo. I just saw a little bit of Virgo. I know, sorry. Just, you know, when we have a rectification in process, I can't help but keep my eye open. Okay. Forgive me. All right. Sound or speech and the use of words have been regarded by the ancient philosophers and are increasingly so regarded by modern thinkers as the highest agent used by man in molding himself and his surroundings. Thought, speech, and the resultant activity on the physical plane complete the triplicity which make a man what he is and place him where he is. Place him where he is. That's very interesting. Our speech has placed us. So thought, speech, and action. Now, did we read something, or was it in the other class, that you are karmically liable if you speak and act, but you are not karmically liable if a thought enters your mind? Was it here? Or the other class?
We
did. Did we not? Yeah. Okay, we did.
Where did that come from?
Well, the idea is that if you render your thought into speech or action, it is a karmic liability. But if you simply entertain a thought or you receive a thought, as long as it's a bad one, you kick it out, you're not karmically liable. We'll have to find the exact page where we were working. Well, you know, if you hold the thought, if you nurture the thought, and it's an evil thought, then you are probably karmically liable. But the act of speaking or doing is they are both very Saturnian acts. Now think about Mercury and Saturn. Mercury is the reception. Zip. You get it. It's there. What are you going to do with it? Well, but when you speak, you use your throat center and Saturn. When you act, you use Saturn on the physical plane. You have frozen your thought into some form. So hence the karmic liability. Okay.
Can I ask a very quick corollary question?
Yeah.
Regarding music.
Yes.
Black Lodge, if I were to say that the Black Lodge tends to not favor music.
They love heavy metal.
How about rap?
Well, hold on, because heavy metal is very non-melodic and in fact dissonant often.
Yeah, that's the point.
Also,
that's the point. About, what'd you say?
There's rhythmic stuff involved too. I read a work about the muscle testing stuff years ago and found out that the waltz is like the perfect rhythm for the human body. But the reverse, I think it's with heavy metal. I don't know if those of them, but the heavy metal was a reverse of that.
Reverse of the waltz? Rum-pum-pum-pum-pum-pum-pum-pum. What is there? Who knows meter?
So it's one, two, three, rum, bum, ba, rum, bum, ba. All of the race. One, two, three, one, two, three.
What is, there's dactylic and trochaic and iambic and anapestic and what is dum bum ba? Does anybody remember what dum bum ba is? No, but it's true. I have heard that the reverse of that is rum bum ba, rum bum ba. This is the rock beat. I use that deliberately in one song. It was sort of a Vulcan song, you know. I come forth, and from the plane of mind I rule, you know. But anyway, that is the opposite of the waltz. You see, the accent is on the first beat.
First and second beat.
Well, that's different. That's not one of the conventional meters, but bum-bum-ba. That
well,
is that is much favored in rock, much favored. But you know, I like some rock music. You know, it's pretty good.
They also found that the system accommodates over time to that which is not healthy, and that becomes the new healthy norm.
Oh, that becomes the health norm. Okay.
Yeah.
How interesting!
For
instance,
sugar naturally is gives you a negative energetic response. Okay.
Yes.
And honey gives you a positive one. But if all you use is sugar and you never use honey, that sugar becomes your now positive one.
Really? Okay. And does it have good effect? Is there hope here?
So there's hope to change.
Okay.
But it's not part of the
well, you know,
and you'll get cancer and or whatever.
But you'll be happy about it.
Right.
Look, it goes all the way back to the Vedas. there were a number of meters, fundamental meters in the Vedas. And these meters...
What is meter?
A meter is an arrangement of beats where one or more of them is strong and others are weaker. Uh-huh. And it's usually done in poetry. So Macromoria talks about the rhythm of Mahavan and Chotavan, two types of fire which have their own rhythm. Okay. So we've kind of lost the key on this, but the old mantras were spoken in certain rhythms. And their effectiveness was considered very dependent upon these rhythms and upon the tones and upon the value given to the words. DK says it's not so important anymore, he says. Right now it's more meaning that's important. Because like you said, if you're an Atlantean, you can do a lot of good magic like a parrot. You don't know what you're doing. You just repeat what you've heard, and it's effective. Well, that only goes so far, right? So we're stepping out of the stage of literal repetition into the stage of understanding. But now, suppose you could put the two of them together. Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, right now, we don't have the rhythms and all of the details and the notes and the colors and the forms. We will have them again. And if by that time we understand the meanings of these things and then can use the literal spiritual numerals in the way they're supposed to be, we will be very effective. Very effective. Yes?
So you said that Buddhism and its various chanting of all these things is in fact an Atlantean throwback. A lot of words going on in Buddhism, and I know some Buddhists and they have no clue what they're doing.
Yeah. Well. Well, we want to, and remember the melodic value is now gone to many of those things. Although I have heard the Dalai Lama chant, there's a little melody there.
Well, I think that's esoteric. These are exoteric.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and rap music. Who said rap earlier? It has no melody. It's strictly throat center.
Yeah.
It's third and seventh ray only.
Yeah.
Okay.
Rhythm and voice.
Yeah, it's the intellect and the all beauty of melody is gone.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's only one small part. It's like the old patter song in some of the comic operas.
Right.
Rap is preceded by that, but even then there was melody.
So that is
very powerful.
Yeah, it can be very powerful.
The ancient
it can hit your, it can, not only your throat center, it's directly related to the lower chakras.
Right.
Can be, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, and there's a lot of lethal stuff being spoken there.
Right.
So it's the words of power in a lower sense, and words of death even, mm-hmm. as you can see.
And is that an arena for us to counter with, in fact, words of power of goodness, love, you know,
sure. And with melody, harmony, counterpoint, you know, I've read this to you before, but I just have to deviate slightly, if you don't mind, and even if you do, I'm sorry. it's good old JSB. You know, remember JSB?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
I want to demonstrate to the world the architect of a new and beautiful social commonwealth. The secret of my harmony, I alone know it. Each instrument in counterpoint, and as many contrapuntal parts as there are instruments. It is the enlightened self-discipline of the various parts, each voluntarily imposing on itself the limits of its individual freedom for the well-being of the community. This is my message, not the autocracy of a single stubborn melody on the one hand, nor the anarchy of the unchecked noise on the other. No, a delicate balance between the two, an enlightened freedom, the science of my art, the harmony of the stars in the heavens, the yearning for the brotherhood in the hearts of men. This is the secret of my music.
Can you...
would you like that?
can you, in our package, can you include this?
Yes, if somebody just tells me what the package is, I'll be happy to throw it in.
That's the end of every day.
Yeah,
that's the package.
Okay.
You're going to play a little bit of Bach now.
Well, you know, he was... What was it when Carl Sagan was supervising what was to go into one of these capsules that was, you know, to be found out there someday to indicate what our civilization was, and someone wanted to throw Bach in, at Bach in, and he said, let's not brag. Something like that.
It was the Voyager program.
Was it Voyager or both? Both to brag.
They put in some rock and roll tune. They put in some Chuck Berry.
Well, I guess right there you see the perspective on things. And Bach was not too well. He was known in Germany, but he was third best. When he finally was chosen for the place in St. Thomas, it was the St. Thomas Conservatory or something, where he had the responsibility of writing a new cantata every Sunday, you know, for every Sunday, they only chose him because they couldn't get the two people they wanted. So in his day, among those who knew something, he was certainly deeply respected. But he was considered old-fashioned, and, you know, his music quickly faded away until Mozart one day was buying fish. You know the story. So someone goes and brings the fish wrapped in this paper, and he unwraps the fish. It's music. He starts to read. And he runs there and he buys up all the paper in which they've been wrapping the fish, because he had discovered Bach, you know. Bach was hidden away somewhere, you know. His whole Saint, what was it, Saint John? There's a passion, the equal of St. Matthew, that's totally lost. You know, and you know what the St. Matthew passion is. If you listen to the St. Matthew passion, you know, my God, it's, you know, it's sublime. And there's one, I think it's the St. John passion. It's lost. You know, just lost. But someone enjoyed their fish. Okay, you know, whatever. So Mozart could hear it in his mind, of course, immediately, and he was one of the principal people involved in the redemption, the revival of Bach. Bach, the greatest musician of the Western society, with Beethoven and Mozart each emphasizing something other and something necessary and wonderful, but Bach somehow took harmony and counterpoint to its acme. And he was a numerologist, and he was an occultist, and he was always spelling things in covert code in the middle of his pieces. You know, he would write things and on the various notes, and they would spell out things like God is great and all the rest of it. And they'd probably rather hear it from him than from the others. So and he was a kind of a Mason. You know, he was a member of an occult lodge and so forth. So these are the things. Was he an initiate? You bet he was an initiate. Meaning third degree, right? Wouldn't you say? And what ray was he on? Well, it seems the fourth ray. The soul of German. You know, whether that means whether he transferred to the second ray or whatever, we don't know. But I'm sure he's coming back in the new Renaissance. So, that new Renaissance is very close to us. Yeah. Very close to us, and it's going to make a difference in harmonizing the world, because a whole lot that we cannot do with politics right now and with arguing, we may be able to do with music. In the National Music Camp, which had a fourth ray soul, I attended that for 6 years. There's this thing that Kresge, who is, you know, kind of the dime store stuff, he dedicated this big auditorium dedicated to the promotion of human friendship through the universal language of the arts. You know. And that's exactly true. When you can have cultural exchange, then people don't have to worry about politics and religious theology. You know, they can meet on the basis of a universal language. Yes. Yes.
I remember at Kresge's in Irvington, New Jersey, it had a lunch counter in the middle of the store where the people would meet and talk. I remember always saying that people were always talking at the lunch counter in the middle of the dime store, which actually made a social circle.
Yeah, yes. Maybe this man had some kind of understanding about, you know, rapport and you know, use his money. So many of the philanthropists come in on the second or third ray. Mm-hmm. they have the third ray stuff going, but they're influenced by the second ray, and it turns into the love of man, right? Okay, so the purpose of all speech is to clothe thought and thus make our thoughts available for others. When we speak, we evoke a thought and make it present. And we bring that which is concealed into audible expression. Okay, I mean, this is, you know, fairly fundamental, but it doesn't hurt to review it. Speech reveals, and right speech can create a form of beneficent purpose, just as wrong speech can produce a form which has a malignant objective. You know, the so-called word of death, and we all know that in divorce courts there's all of this stuff about mental abuse, and you can be sure that it's been accompanied by verbal abuse. Without realizing this, however, ceaselessly and irresponsibly, day after day, we speak. Whoa. Would someone like to read this? We use words, we multiply sounds, and surround ourselves with form worlds of our own creation, all with karmic implications. Is it not essential, therefore, that before we speak, we should think, thus remembering the injunction, you must attain to knowledge ere you attain to speech. Now, what is that, a question mark? Why is that there? Oh, okay, I see. Okay. Having thought, let us then choose the right words to express the right thought, attempting to give correct pronunciation, proper values, and true tonal quality to every word we utter. Gosh, it sounds almost as tough as harmlessness. But harmlessness was yesterday.
I was healthcare today with all of that speech going on, all the yelling and, you know, stuff, shouting people down. They showed one in Northern California where the local senator, local congressman, has established some rules for discourse.
Mm-hmm.
So she has some enforcers there. And she said in the beginning, look, here are the rules. We're here to listen to one another. So when you're done, you know, that's it. No yelling, no screaming. If you want to yell and scream, you'll be asked to leave and quickly. So when you watch this discourse that went on, it was interesting to see people who were really frightened about healthcare voice their concerns. And others voice, you know, some of their concerns. Well, let's have this thing forth. It was such a contrast in tone. I thought, not many of these things happen. Most of them were just this explosion of malignant objective in terms of long speech. But I thought it was so impressive to see what could happen when the right rules were set up and people actually basically were forced to abide by them.
Mm.
There were people who started to shout from the back of the room, and there were those there who escorted them out.
Really?
Sorry, but this is not the meeting for you.
They did take
them. Were they uniformed escorters? In some cases, yes. Yeah.
Well, they have a sheriff sitting in the front of the room.
But the rules were designed to get a better form of speech, so there could be some kind of, it's supposed to be a dialogue, you know, at least a shouting match.
Yes, yes.
But the tone is so negative in most of these, as you probably know.
Well, we missed it. We missed it somewhat, because we were out of the country.
I have not seen that.
But every night in the news, it's so wonderful. It's hard to watch. I mean, we just kind of shut it off.
That was their
yes.
I know, but it was produced.
All right.
Related, which is stopping.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this is so accessible to us. The speech is so accessible. We are humanity. We are the third throat center of Sanat Kumara. We use our throat center all the time. And, of course, these two things are related, aren't they? Speech and harmlessness.
Yep.
Yep. I mean, there are other ways to be harmful, as we discussed yesterday, but speech and harmful. And it's not always what we think it is. There are various ways of being harmful through speech, and it's not just through verbal attack. It can be through neglect, saying things which are dismissive, not appreciative when appreciation is due. There are many ways that we can reduce the quality of someone else's life or our own through harmful speech.
It's no
accident that those two are linked with self-forgiveness and the
very, very correct. You know, self-forgetfulness, the ego is the first principle. Harmlessness, if we've forgotten our ego, lower ego, we have a chance here with harmlessness, and right speech will be to follow.
Yeah, so often
yeah.
Wrong speech is motivated by some sort of selfish purpose.
Right.
Usually,
absolutely.
As it certainly wasn't the case of the example you're bringing up.
Yeah. Or, you know, calling attention to yourself or something like that. You know, the Ahamkara principle is always there. The eyes are always on the self when wrong speech is occurring.
It comes from fear and defensiveness. And
Yeah. And fear of defensiveness only occur when there's an ego. You know, the old Vedantin saying, wherever there are two, there is fear.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is a very interesting statement, because there's, you know, self and the other. You see?
Still, within that Vedanta framework, I have seen some of those high swamis,
really?
Their students, and the students will say, oh, I'll never forget what Swami so and so really let me have it.
It
changed my life. Not all that cut.
No.
The motive.
No.
It's the motive.
Because the motive will be established, its pattern behind the, what one says, right?
But right speech is not necessarily nice speech.
Right.
So in the case of the guru correcting the student, that's not wrong speech. And it is harmless. Even though it may hurt the hearer.
Right, he's going to
because
say...
Because of its purpose, and it's not coming from a selfish thing.
Right.
No.
And it's not necessarily malignant that citizens shout at politicians who for long periods of time have decided not to listen to their constituents and do what they have to do.
Sure.
Although in the case that Sheldon was describing, that was specifically and purposely conjured up by people who wanted to derail the program and wanted to prevent there being an effective public dialogue.
Right. So when Mao was so extremely kind in his speech to the Dalai Lama, was this harmless? See what I mean? What was the motive? What was the motive here? To just tranquilize the Dalai Lama into forgetting his mission and so forth? So it's the same thing with the surgeon, you know, you don't want him to be nice to your disease. You know, if he cuts you open and finds something that has to go, you know, he has to show some first rate. Then, so anyway, let me repeat this, please, because it's somehow really important. Having thought, let us choose the right words to express the right thought, attempting to give correct pronunciation, proper values, and true tonal quality to every word we utter. It sounds so uncompromising, doesn't it? You know, it sounds so, you know, sounds very formal. And Saturn will control the throat center. Not Earth, producing that fecundity of forms that, you know, is just almost without limit. Earth is fantastic for producing multiplicity. And then it's the first ray monad of Earth, survival of the fittest. I'll make all these forms, but only some will get through.
And it's interesting because it's that esoteric ruler of Sagittarius, and Hercules has to all the sounds.
He has to subdue all the many sounds with the symbols. CYMBALS, which can be considered to be the one synthetic sound which drives away all of the nonsense.
You know, Manly Hall was a master at least on the sage. About all of his
examples.
Examples
of Manly Hall doing this on stage?
Well, his lectures that he put in on Sundays. He just used all of those things.
Quality, monotone.
Was he fairly monotone?
He was very
Or was
no,
that?
For the enduring monotone, I had to concentrate because it wasn't.
Was it when he was older?
When he was older.
Uh-huh, because it could have been an energy thing.
But every word, in place.
Every word in place, absolutely.
If you talk for 2 hours without a note, it'd be like, you could spend 5 days trying to write it that properly. It would just float out of
it. Well, there's another guy that was, I think, there you're dealing with the initiate consciousness. It seems clear. He came right out of the ageless wisdom, and his job was to represent it before the world in the most dignified way he could. So he, somehow a union of the second ray and the seventh ray. He was very keen on Master R, and on ritual, and his whole volume of sacred, Masonic, Kabbalistic, and Rosicrucian symbolic philosophy.
The Western mystery tradition.
Yeah, it's so Master R, and I think there's a big picture of the Count in the opening part of it.
Mm-hmm. What about Obama's major speeches? I think of the one on race. There's so many of them that he's given, but each one of those is about pronunciation, proper values, and total quality. These things are not only inspiring, they're just of a different order.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to contrast him with Bush in terms of pronunciation.
Oh.
These were something totally passionate.
Yeah. Well, you have a soul of a different order,
Yes.
And I think, he has that kind of incantational, oratorical skill that Martin Luther King had, it seems to go in the black race very strong, that musical value of sound, very strong.
Wasn't Janet Dessen supposed to be one of the best orators ever? I've heard that.
I hear that she was.
Was she around when recordings were made? Is there any recordings?
Well, she was around when recordings were made, but I don't know if there are any recordings. She died in 1933, was it? And Leadbeater shortly after? In the 30s, right? And, recordings were around. You wouldn't get the same... But maybe we could find out if there were recordings of any Besson.
A lot of effort to make a recording at that time.
In those days.
I
think she, and she also had the sixth ray. If you study her life, this is like, I think, a sixth ray personality. So she went from one devotion to another, one folk, until finally she found theosophy. Maybe we could dig that up. That'd be amazing, to hear that.
I wonder if, Wheaton or someplace, they don't have something.
I'll bet they would. I can't imagine that with recordings having existed already for 50 years before she died.
To the movies by then,
right? Yeah, the talkies came in at
27
with the jazz singer.
Yeah.
Yes. Al Jolson. Okay. All right. Let's go on. We're talking 29, was it?
29.
We're talking about the right value of speech, okay? And we're talking about speech in relation to the magical process. Then will our spoken word create a thought form which will embody the idea we have in our minds. And so, when we're working here and we're trying to express some of these abstruse ideas or impressions that may come upon us, we're actually working at this task right here. So many things the Tibetan might say are obscure, and they stimulate in us maybe some vague impression, and we want to render our impression as clear as we can possibly make. Are you heading out, Gerald?
Yes, I am. Okay. I will, with apologies to everybody.
Okay. Take care of yourself.
I will.
Okay.
Long to have you.
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. Okay. See you later. See you later, Gerald.
Bye, Patrick.
Okay. Gerald will be in touch.
Yes.
Okay. Take care. Then, too, will our words carry no discord, but will add their quota to that great harmonizing chord or unifying word which it is the function of mankind ultimately to utter. You know how so many great symphonies end with one blazing final chord.
And they shoot. If there is not, are you agreeing? If there is not, you are like,
you're waiting for something
still
that doesn't happen.
And then there's silence, and then somebody starts.
Yeah, yeah. my clapping goes before my comprehension, but I know it's right. Well, you know, Beethoven is one who really ends with the big chords, and Brahms does too, and usually you get the sense of harmonious finality with a great work of symphonic art. So anyway, one day Humanity is supposed to do this. Now, we're in the process of a composition called the Solar Sonata. You've heard about that. Solar Locus is composing a sonata. It turns out that Sanat Kumara is composing a symphony. And we are all parts of that symphony. So I think the degree to which we can attune ourselves to all fellow notes and chords, it's interesting to consider each other like a fellow chord. You know, each one of us is sounding all the time. And wouldn't it be interesting? I mean, in the fourth ray age, I think this will be prominent, how we look at each other. Yeah.
Can't resist. To me, anyway, when you look at the Olympics, the last Olympics was in China, as you remember. One of those ceremonies that were so, even though the Chinese did them, were so universal, so adopted, all of humanity. I mean, all of this tries to do this. I thought this was one of the more amazing things I've ever seen.
They really knew how to stage it, didn't they? I mean, the amount of control they had.
It celebrated all of humanity. It wasn't just the Chinese.
Yeah.
It was truly historic.
Yeah. It was a great seventh-ray synthesis somehow, using all of the possibilities. When I saw that guy somehow lighting the torch flying through the air, I said, how are they doing this? Yeah. Wrong speech separates, and it is interesting to bear in mind that the word, the symbol of unity, is divine, whereas speech in its many diversifications is human. So we really need to move from the, from the three to the two to the one. We have to speak the word of unity from the many, many words we might otherwise utter, but then we have to speak the word of reality, the one, you know, which finally represents things as they actually are. Not just the unification of the parts, but the word of the essence. And I always like what he says about Christ's first ray mind. You know, he didn't answer the devil with the wordy disquisitions of the concrete mind. Meaning he said, let's sit down and talk about this, Samael, you know. No, it just was with a principle, bang, just like that. And it set, and that principle set the action of all to come for centuries to come. Like when we're in the desert now and we're being tempted by the devil, we know what to say, right? Or do we? I think it was Peter that said, get thee behind me, Satan. Didn't he say that? I mean, when speaking to Peter, when Peter was basically saying, well, you don't have to go through all this, you know, he said to him, get thee behind me, Satan. But when he said, man does not live by bread alone, or thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God, you know, or it is written, thou shalt not. And what was the other one? I'm almost forgetting it.
That was Jesus.
Well, this is Jesus in the
desert,
and he's speaking to the devil. So one, you know, it says, man shall not live by bread alone, that was the flesh, and it is written that thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. This was throw yourself down, and you will be recognized and will have dominion over all of these.
My body will be rebuilt in 3 days.
Might be. There was one other thing. Wait, temptations. Let me look at the temptations. I almost threw that. No, get thee behind me, Satan, was said to Peter.
No, but did he not? Don't use the your
car. Say it and finish.
I said use that because I don't know what is that word in
English. Okay, temptations. Did I underline it? Okay, here it is. Somewhere. Devil of pride. Then the devil came, taketh him up to the holy city, and setteth him upon a pinnacle of the temple, and saith unto him, if thou be the Son of God, cast thyself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge concerning thee, and in their hands they shall bear thee up, lest at any time thou dash thy foot against a stone. And Jesus said unto him, it is written again, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. So that's one of them. Okay, that's one of them. And let's see if I have any other. Oh, they're all here. Oh, here's another one. And again, the devil. No, that was it.
No.
Get thee hence.
Yeah.
This is where
then Jesus said, "Get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve." This is when he offers him the world, right? Is this, he offers him the world, you know, the world, the flesh, and the devil. And again, he taketh him up to exceeding high mountain, that's twice, and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory thereof, and saith unto him, but the word again, he must have done something before. Get thee hence, Satan. No, you're right. He said unto Jesus, Jesus said unto him, get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. So, that's it. Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. Man does not live by bread alone. And get thee hence, for thou shalt worship only the Lord thy God.
So there's the flesh, the power, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. Which one is that?
I believe that this one is about the world. I believe that throw thyself down and prove thyself to be immortal is about the devil. These people will, I think so, but I might be wrong. Now let's go up here and say, I'll look up bread. What about bread? Definitely with bread. Is there anything else? There's nothing else about bread. Wait a second. Try it. I know that he's supposed to hit the rock, right, and produce bread or something like that. Bread and butter. Here it is. This is it. Yes, because he was very hungry. So this is it here. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth from the mouth of God. This is desire, as Lucifer. But I don't see. He was. It says Jesus was an hungered. He was hungry, and then the devil said to him, "If you hit this rock, you can make a bread of it, or something like that." Or was that rock in the water? How did he produce the bread? Was he to produce the bread?
No, he didn't.
No, but he was to be able to produce the bread.
Well, the breaking of the loaves and fishes.
No. That's a different one. That's in another place.
He was in the desert, and the devil was tempting him, and he said that he could make of the very stones. Or something.
Yeah, bread. Yeah, bread. To make stone. Bread of the very stones.
He
yes.
Said, don't tempt the Lord thy God. You know, not
okay, so this is the flesh, right? Okay. Well, anyway, the wordy disquisitions of the concrete mind are not here to be found. It's not. Let's talk about the meaning of bread. No, it's not about that, is it? It's not about meaning. It's gone beyond that. This is significance. This is atma. This is power. He had an atmic mind. Is it quite astonishing, really? No, the devil has a third-ray mind. Jesus had Christ had an atmic mind, first-ray. I don't know about Jesus himself. We're told that the rays of the Christ were 2, 6, 1. That's the Christ, not Jesus. I think Jesus' rays were 6, 1, 1. Something like that.
And it's interesting that, in a sense, that sentence up there is equating bread with the word of God.
Right.
Energy. To me, that's
Okay, that's it. Word is the energy of God giving vitality just as bread does. Yeah, and it feeds the flesh. See, this is the second ray one. This is the second ray.
There's
temptation.
Also to the word bread, I've had the opportunity to read Neil Douglas Quatt's book on translations of the Aramaic.
Mm.
He was a deep Aramaic scholar, and bread has as its root this concept of understanding, which is second way. You know, it's not just bread itself, but the understanding that goes with it. So to think about digesting something and understanding it. And
in this magical process, what you eat, you become that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So then we have to look at, you know, if we don't live by understanding alone, then what's...
Okay. Well, okay, yeah. But I think, you know, there, in a way, there's something obvious. Vitality cometh from the word and from understanding.
You know, there is exactly that... like the higher understanding of the higher law, because where he says that you Lucifer says to Christ or Jesus that you make that what is from here, from this world, your bread. And there he tells, no, I am living from that bread, what is from the spirit. Mm-hmm. That's why he does mm-hmm. not become the flesh or the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like the letter of the law and the spirit of the law.
Yes.
The devil's offering the letter.
Exactly. The devil always offers concretion. And, Lynn, can we fill that out?
Oh, yes.
I mean, you know.
You
didn't know I wanted bread.
It
was a good recovery. The truth of the matter is that a silent comment is being made.
How much is it?
Six. Yes, boy, it's a very fitting moment, isn't it? Thanks for your patience. I just put up the case again. Okay, anyway, I think that's important. Jesus, or the Christ, spoke in principles and used words to such great effect, such that those words are blazed on everybody's consciousness for 2,000 years, emblazoned. The Buddha too. You know, the Buddha may have had a six-ray mind, but if you read some of the things he said, he speaks with utter simplicity. And I don't know where in the sixth ray arose. I think maybe it induced aspiration in people, perhaps. You know, the sixth ray mind, you know, someday someone should sit down and say, what is it that the Catholic Church and Buddha have in common through their sixth ray mind? What is it about the pronouncements that they both have made that reveals the sixth ray as the qualifier of the mental vehicle? But I was so impressed, you know, I expected to see some sort of aspirational speech from the Buddha, but it was absolute simplicity. It was from the greater wheel or the... What was it? Some of those big orange books. You would know what they are. They've been published recently.
Not the Tripitaka, but sort of the canon.
Well, it just describes various experiences, or maybe it's just sayings of the Buddha, you know. But it describes how they all went to this grove. And they sat in this grove and they talked about this. Then they went on to another grove and they had another conversation and so forth.
Well, I think Christ.
Yes, they go from place to place and talk.
Well, in one sense, they're speaking the law, but also by keeping it simple, it's easier for humanity to hold on to it and for it to be passed along.
Absolutely.
Sort of like the parables.
Absolutely.
It's a real compact container there that's a lot harder to mess up than
all of the wordy disquisitions of the concrete mind. Yeah.
People simpler in those days and less educated.
Oh, sure.
Sure. They needed to hear it in a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah, but even...
The complexity of thinking that we have to know.
But even today, I have a feeling that the Christ would not speak in a lot of complexity, which can be misinterpreted. But let's go forward. As evolution proceeds and the human family rises into its true position in the great plan of the universe, right and correct speech will increasingly be cultivated, because we shall think more before we utter words, or, as a great teacher has said, I wonder if it's KH. Through meditation, we shall rectify the mistakes of wrong speech. You know, usually when he says, a great teacher says, and he doesn't specify, it's usually his own teacher, KH. At least, I believe it is. And the significance of word forms, true and correct sounds, and vocal quality will be ever more apparent. Well, it's we could stand to reread that frequently and do something about it.
So this idea of true meditation, we can correct or modify the mistakes of wrong speech.
Yeah.
I'm thinking how sometimes I think to do those things, but I don't know if that's what it refers, like, for example, I have used a wrong speech in the circumstances, and then I realize that, and then I maybe visualize the same situation that send light to repair that.
Sure.
Does that refer to that, or?
Yeah, or re-speak it, or,
Recreate the same scenario, but heal, or...
I think that is very important, even though we would be saying the correct, correct that with the person or wherever, but to go backwards, and because there are these lies which were sent forth, and that's why we should try to bless them or correct that pattern what is evolving in the ethers.
I do that naturally all the time.
Yeah.
Trying to correct from the past, and it's part of our thought form thing, cutting off thought form. So now here we have this dichotomy, correcting and dwelling on this correction for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, but where do we stop?
Maybe we have to have some faith that the... the correction sent forth is a... And also through meditation we may detect where we have gone wrong.
Also.
As we review the day, we may not have realized it, and then, and then we see where the error has been made. Now we have the second word. It's light. First the sound, and then the first effective sound, the pouring forth of light, causing the revelation of the thought form. And Lynn said it took some 800,000 years since the Big Bang, according to that cosmology, for light to break forth.
350.
Did you say 350,000?
I want to know exactly.
He makes it up as he goes along, right? Yeah. Okay. Light is known by what is revealed. The absence of light produces a fading away into apparent non-existence of the phenomenal world. Now, actually, we have to, in a way, cease to throw light upon the phenomena. PHL. Upon the phenomenal world while we are meditating. Sorry. Meditating on higher worlds. In other words, we want the lower worlds to fade out. We want the sounds of those worlds to be the sights. We want to be able to concentrate inwardly so we do not, we are not preoccupied with outer things. Light is known by what is revealed. That is very interesting. So when something emerges, it is the result of light. So the emergence into the visual sphere, into visual perception, let's say, arises because of light. And we all always talk about things coming to light. Something new has appeared on the horizon. Something new has entered consciousness. Whenever something new shows up in the content of consciousness, it is the result of light.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Of course, it's also possible that something of a sound nature could show up too, but then even that sound is brought to light. It means, it is the emergence out of non non-being into being, apparent non-being into being.
But
yes.
Is it also implying that if something weren't revealed, I mean, as a form, that the light wouldn't be known, that it's only by it shining upon something that we're aware of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's only, yeah. Light is known by what is revealed. So if there were no
revealed, yeah. If there were no form for the light to shine upon, the light would remain invisible.
Aha, uh-huh. Well, that's interesting too, isn't it? Although, you know, you wonder, yeah, can universal light be seen in and of itself? It's like pure consciousness, pure light, pure sound, you know, without an object. Can there be, there's consciousness without an object, can there be light without an object? The sea of light.
There probably is, but can we see it?
Well, probably that's something we strive towards in our highest meditations, you know. There are stories about that, trying to enter the ocean of light. And some of the old Kabbalistic stories show the questing of the meditator after the light divine. You know, what is that great light? Not Shekinah, but there's something... No. It's like Ein Sof is like the infinite reality, but there is Ein Sur. Is there something like that? S-U-R?
Not sure.
The word U-R, Ur, means light. But I'm thinking there is some primeval light out of which all things came, and you hear these old stories about the rabbinical students trying to rise higher and higher into the supernal light. Which, in and of itself, regardless of what it reveals. Sometimes I think it's Sophia, you know, is the light of wisdom or something like that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, is it? Is it Sophia?
Sophia. Yeah, it's
because
it's sanctified.
Does the word A-I-N mean negation? Is there a negation? Because I'm thinking about Ein Sof, not light. Wow. Okay, anyway. So light is known by what is revealed. The thought form created by the sound is intended to be a source of revelation. Now this is, so not only is it revealed, but it is meant to reveal. Not only is it revealed, but its purpose is to reveal. It must reveal truth and bring an aspect of reality to the cognizance of the onlooker. This is the purpose for the creation. Why? If it's not revelatory, don't create it. Hence, the second quality of the thought form in its highest use is that it brings light to those who need it, to those who walk in darkness. Well, we certainly see the motive here for the creation of any thought form. Now, what was the first? What was the first one? Oops, sorry. The motive is revealed here. So what is the first use? What is the first quality? And what is the second? Motive is revealed. What is the first, the second quality and the first quality? The second quality is to make sure it is revelatory. What is the first quality? It's light, first sound and light causing the revelation of thought. Light is, well, maybe that's what is meant here. Light is known by that which is revealed. The absence of light produces a fading wave. The thought form created by the sound is intended to be, hence the second quality of the thought form is to reveal. Well, I guess maybe the first is that it is revealed, and the second is that it be revealing. Perhaps that's it.
Doesn't it refer the first quality to the principle before the sound, and the second quality refers to...
You might be right. Hence, the second quality of the thought form, in its highest use, is that it brings light. Maybe. First quality of the thought form may be sound, or there may be two qualities related to light. Well, we'll try to figure that out as we go along. Because certainly sound is the first thing that comes. In other words, a note produces the thought form. Right? The egoic note produces the thought form. Okay. Then perhaps light emerges, the thought form comes to light. It is revealed, which is the other possibility. The thought form is revealed and is meant to be revealing. I'll just put that in. I deal not here with the light as the soul, with light as the soul, cosmically or individually. I touch not upon light as the universal second aspect of divinity. I seek only, in these instructions, to deal with that aspect of truth which will make the aspirant a practical worker, and so enable him to work with intelligence. So he's not getting into the metaphysical speculations, no metaphysics here. His main work, increasingly he will find this to be so, is to create thought forms to carry revelation to thinking human beings. So why do you create thought forms? Why do I create thought forms? Is it only for this purpose, to bring revelation? Or is there also, if no revelation, ego gratification? Do we create any thought forms that yield ego gratification rather than produce revelation?
Yeah.
Yep, we do. We do. It is so good, this book, because it forces you to examine everything you're creating. It's about creativity, isn't it? We're making things all the time. And what is the quality, the motive, the purpose behind what we're making?
But it's also very, in a way, attuning, because then there's so many possibilities of what we can be creating in the world. It's just,
that's the purpose for these rules. And when you really start to think about it, Earth must give place to Saturn. Now, what's interesting, in this third great third ray entity that is one of the persons of the Trinity, Saturn is the mental body of the entity, and Earth is the vital or physical body. Mars is the astral body. So our Earth rules the throat center of the uncaring, unwitting speaker. And Saturn rules the throat center of the purposeful, clan-dominated speaker. Uranus gets in there some too. We have to go to Saturn. This is a very Saturnian book. Do this, don't do that. There's a lot of it. And we should be grateful for that. Because Saturn brings relief. Saturn's the god of opportunity. By not doing certain things, we can do others. That's what Saturn tells us. If we refrain from this, you will be able to do that. The principle of sacrifice. All right. To do this, he must work occultly. To do what? Thought forms to carry revelation to thinking human beings. I guess there's a limited audience there. But it'll be an increasing audience. To do this, he must work occultly, and through the sound of his breathe forth work, which is coming later in the rule, he's going to breathe it forth. Coming later, sorry. Through the truth revealed in form, he will carry light and illumination into the dark places of the earth. In other words, in a way, he becomes a teacher. This is what a teacher is. A teacher, a light bearer. This is called the ray of light bearing influence. The light carrier. Okay. We're dealing with the second factor, which is light. Now, the most luminous type of soul is the second ray soul. Said, the most luminous ray lord is the fifth ray lord. There's a bit of a difference there. Yes.
Yes. An interesting insight. It's related, but it's interesting because I've often thought of the white magic process is a kind of manifestation process, which it is. But a lot of the stuff we read on manifestation today does not have as its goal the revelation, the thought forms which reveal something useful for humanity.
Right.
I'm thinking now, I'm just differentiating in my own mind the difference between the white magic process and other manifestation processes, which look somewhat similar. There is similarity here, but they are of a different purpose. And not the purpose, by the way. Sometimes they're very useful. It's how do you manifest things you need in your life?
Mm-hmm,
this
sure.
is what we're talking about here. This is a very different kind of, that's what I'm getting anyway so far. It's a different motive, a different theme.
So manifestation may be devoid of soul.
Well, it's not necessarily devoid, but it doesn't have the same purpose. It's more for the,
In other words, soul motives are not behind all manifestation.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
Missing from many types of very successful manifestation.
They may not be bad motives either, but I mean, not necessarily these kind of motives.
Exactly. No. Well, that's why we call it the white magic of the soul.
Yeah.
There's magic and there's white magic. And the word white introduces the synthetic perspective of the soul. Synthetic perspective of the soul. Then finally, okay, so he makes his revelation, his thought form carries revelation. Then he finally makes his thought form live through the power of his own assurance, spiritual understanding, and vitality. Now, some of you are familiar with Roberto Assagioli's Act of Will book. Probably many are familiar with it. And in those six stages of the will, I think there comes the fourth stage, which is called affirmation, in which he strengthens the thought form he has purposefully decided or chosen to create. It is then purposefully strengthened. So another thing, too, is when we're when we haven't made a clean decision that we really want to do something, our assurance factor is interrupted, and we don't have the coherent energy behind it.
Yeah.
DK said that so much of our ineffectiveness has to do with not having the single eye. We haven't really focused all of our energy in one direction. We're split. We've divided the manifestational strength. So anyway, the thought forms are living through, they live through our confidence. They live through our confidence. They live through our spiritual understanding of their purpose, because when we understand what they're for, we stay with them. And they live through our own vitality. We put our own ether into them. We strengthen them with ether. With prana, let's call it prana. Okay. Thus, the significance of the third word, vibration, appears. Okay. His message is heard, for it is sounded forth. It carries. Is this the first quality we're asking, Tara?
Next, moving to the third vibration.
Okay. It carries. It is revealed and carries the illumination, for it conveys the truth and reveals reality. Why so? Because the ego started it. And the ego's perception is nothing but truth and the perception of reality. And it is a vital, for it carries truth and reality. It is of vital import, for it vibrates with the light of its creator and is held in being as long as his thought and sound and intelligence animate it. Well, that's quite a mouthful. Okay. It is of vital import. Of course, that usually means that qualitatively it's very good. But it means that it has vitality as well. And it vibrates with the life of its creator. So I don't think we want to see a devitalized white magician, do we? It's a contradiction. I'm sorry. White magician, a devitalized, I feel like that sometimes. MGM. No. How? What is magician? I've done it many times. MGM. A revitalized magician is ineffective and is held in being as long as his thought, his sound, and intelligence animate it. All three. We know about keeping the eye on what you create. What about his sound? The Om? Is he sustaining this with his Om? Silently?
the quality of his life also sounds.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good.
Really an hour.
Okay, quality of his life sounds. And his intelligence. Now, do we have to keep our intelligence going, or do we invest it with intelligence, and thus it keeps going?
Well,
one thing we do have to continue for a while is the I. There's a line, he tells us, of energy between the Creator. Are there nice fly events going on there?
We're praying.
I thought they were appetizers. Okay, did we invest it? Okay, and the sound went forth, and he says, when you keep your eye on that which you have created, you sustain it via your eye. When you take your eye off it, it falls apart, and you stop caring.
I still have the eye. It's attention.
Yeah.
Attention. Yeah. Right. And even, you know, maybe the kind of attention that's produced by the third eye.
But do we also need to add sound, thought, and intelligence to keep it alive?
Yeah. I don't know. It says it is held in being. I'll tell you what. Maybe. Yes, this is it. This is the creative process before release. There we go.
Okay.
After it's released, we use a different thing. This is true of a message, of an organization, and of all forms of life, which are but the embodied ideas of a cosmic or human creator. Students will find it of value to take these three vital words, sound, light, vibration, and trace the relation to all embodied thought forms. A cosmos, a plane, a kingdom in nature, a race, and an egg. It's rather interesting, this list of thought forms. A plane is an embodied thought form. Actually, a plane is a sphere. A ray is an embodied thought form. A ray is a sphere. Yes. These are all beings. Consider the diverse groups of creating agencies. Solar logoi, solar angels, human beings, and others. Consider the sphere of the creative process and see how true the old commentary is when it says, okay, the sound reverberated amidst the varying wheels of uncreated matter, and lo, the sun and all the lesser wheels appeared. The light shone forth amidst the many wheels, and thus the many forms of God, the diverse aspects of his radiant robe, blazed forth. So there was an appearance before the blazing forth. The vibrant, palpitating wheels turned over. Life in its many stages and in its many grades commenced the process of unfolding, and lo, the law began to work. It proceedeth under the law, and naught can hinder now the work from going forward. Forms arose and disappeared, but life moved on. Kingdoms arose, holding their many forms, which drew together, turned together, and later separated, but still the life moved on, always looking for fresh vehicles, right? Mankind, hiding the Son of God, the Word incarnate, broke forth into the light of revelation. That's very revelatory. Races appeared and disappeared. The forms veiling the radiant soul emerged and achieved their purpose and vanished into night. But lo, the life moved on, blending this time with light rather than just form. Life merged with light, both blending to reveal a beauty and a power, an active liberating force, a wisdom and a love we call the Son of God. In other words, we're talking about the production of the second aspect of divinity. C-A-D. Second aspect of divinity is produced by life and light. Through the many sons of God who in their inmost center are but one, God in his fatherhood is known, yet still that lighted life moved on to a dread point of power, a force creative, concerning which we say it is the all, the container of the universe, the persistent center of the spheres, the one. How beautiful. How beautiful. We could take that apart, but I think you understand this, right? I think, you know, we could go into it, but we have enough to do. We have touched upon two words of significance in the fourth rule, sound and light, and one paramount idea emerges. The soul is to be known as light, as the revealer, whilst the spirit aspect will later be recognized as sound. So here he reverses the whole order. And it is the biblical order. First there was sound, then there was light.
Isn't that the way the senses come on board too? Isn't it hearing before sight?
Yes, but it's working up from below. And here he's working down from above. And it doesn't go hearing vision, it goes hearing touch vision. Okay. So touch is involved.
That would be vibration in the sense?
Maybe. Vibration is so much of a, what you would call a common denominator in all of them, really. Okay, but this is important. The soul as light and the spirit as sound. And yet we hear the word of the soul and the light of life itself blazes forth. The spirit is light too. Like I say, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva chase each other's tail. They go around and around and around, and you find them all in each other. It's like if you have a three, you have a nine, which is the number for the three. It's the major cyclic number for the third aspect. Okay. Complete light and illumination is the right of the disciple who attains the third initiation. And that's why this initiation is so often called by a particular name, the illumination, and another name, the enlightenment, the illumination, and the transfiguration. Okay. Whilst the true comprehension of the sound, of the triple AUM, the synthesizing factor in manifestation, only appears to the one who stands master in the three worlds. Okay, the master and the sound, or the Chohan, even, Chohan, and the modatic sound, the O. In other words, when you are on the monadic plane, you no longer sound the O-M per se, although we're told Sanat Kumara for certain purposes sounds the O-M, you sound the O. It's the Jupiter word. Now, when you get into that Rudolf Steiner's method of assigning planets to sounds, the O, the rounded O, which is not an R, is assigned to Jupiter. Now, that's very interesting because the sound per se pours forth from the monadic plane, it's the O, and that plane is ruled by Jupiter. That is the planetary lord of the monadic plane. Certainly of the monad in its great temple of Ezekiel, its vehicle. When we rise up into the sea of fire, perhaps another, you know, more Vulcanian or some Uranian, some different planet rules the volatile essence. Jupiter's not volatile enough. He's too stately. He likes to walk around in robes and hear pomp and circumstance. But once you get into the sea of fire, it's quite different. Okay. The word vibration must next engage our attention, and he's going to link it directly to form, but it may not be dissociated from the next word in the sequence form. Yep, didn't have long to wait. Okay. Okay. So let's put that in, so it stands out. Okay, vibration, the effect of divine activity. It's very clear that everything that we call sound is vibration. Or at least maybe sound is the realization, the phenomenal realization of vibration in our consciousness.
As you say, vibration is present in all the other senses, because it's also when the touch.
Hold that. Absolutely. But of course, you know, the sense and the outer cause are very different things. In other words, vibration is in a way the outer cause of an inner realization. you know, in other words, sound is an inner realization, light an inner realization, and vibration is the common cause, you might say.
Yeah.
But it is not the realization itself.
Yeah,
maybe he means here, Michael, that because this is a kind of magical process, that there is a basic rate of vibration at home, and he's talking about an increase or a change in that basic rate of vibration. So that's why it comes here, meaning as the sound and light are applied, it will do something to a standard.
Well, that's very true. That's very true. But you know, you ask yourself philosophically, is there such a thing as a non-vibratory state of reality? And I've asked myself this many times. Well, you know, I just ask, does anything exist that has no vibration? Because if there is no movement,
in other words,
well,
it's just a hum.
But even a hum, as we know,
that's I'm trying to get to the point that there may be zero and one here.
Yeah, I think zero is nothing. I think without vibration, you have reality.
Without vibration, you have reality.
Yeah, real reality. But I want to point out to you and to myself that the great breath is a vibration. It's an oscillation. Yeah, before manifestation, but also during it. In other words, you cannot separate this breath from, you cannot separate being from non-being. So the great breath, which is the fundamental vibration of all, the fundamental oscillation, includes both non-being and being. It includes both absoluteness and universe. So vibration is very fundamental.
And so it's non-being which produces the right breath.
Well, or is the that's the question. Non-being is like forever, and yet periodicity is forever. I've often pointed out that the first two stanzas of the Secret Doctrine contradict each other. And that's just the way paradox demands that it be. We have this boundless, immutable principle. It's immutable. It's immutable. There's no movement whatsoever, because mutability is movement. It's immutable. Nothing changes. If nothing changes, there's no movement. Unless we say that perpetual change changeth not.
And isn't that a phrase?
Well,
somewhere.
It is now. it's a bit like Heraclitus, isn't it?
Yeah.
That all is motion. So the one thing that doesn't change is the fact that all is motion. Motion is always.
That's the periodicity.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. They go back and forth with each other, and yet we have it's boundless, it's immutable, and you cannot identify anything within it. Therefore, you cannot identify any kind of change. The only thing you can identify is its relation with positivity, with the universe.
Yeah.
An oscillatory relation between being and non-being. It requires a lot of thought. And I haven't solved it.
Well, what you're saying, this is a philosophical look at things, and I was just trying to make the point, maybe, as you said earlier, maybe for this particular body of knowledge here on manifestation, you could put vibration here,
at
this point, third in line.
Third. Well, sure, because if we say, if I sound something, it sets various objects in vibration.
It increases whatever.
If I shine a light, it sets in vibration. So many, many things induce vibration. The question is vibration that which induces all the things that induce vibration?
But in this case, it sounds like he's using more vibration as what is produced, what is coming into manifestation, because...
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Vibration and form. Yeah, exactly so. I was just going philosophical on vibration, showing that at the root of anything we consider to be real is an inescapable oscillation we call the great breath, which is a vibration, which is a regular change, you know. Maybe not all vibration is regular, but this is apparently a regular
change.
And yet, it demands changelessness. Because is there ever a time when absoluteness ceases? It can't, you know. If absoluteness ceases, it's not absoluteness. And if it doesn't cease, it's not periodical. I think we need Christ to come up with a good one-liner. Otherwise, the third ray, you know what can happen.
So everything is vibrating. The universe is vibrating. Don't we read further on in TCF that there's three types of motion, rotating motion, cyclic
yes.
motion, spiral cyclic motion?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they all demand vibration. There's several modifications generally. Generally, there are three, but he gives you four. Well, he gives you rotary motion, then he gives you... he gives you spiral motion, then he gives you spiral cyclic, then he gives you progressive.
Forward, straight
forward. Straight of progress onward. But there's a funny thing. He differentiates spiral motion, cyclic motion, does actually belong to the first ray from one point of consideration, as does progress onward. The spiral cyclic motion contains some of the second ray qualities and third ray qualities. It's a sort of a synthesis. I've written in there in the commentaries differentiating these different types of motion. You probably remember, I don't, but I know it's there.
I just read them somewhere a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, because he breaks up the descriptions of motion. Because, you know, like spiral cyclic, that's second ray. No question about it. You know, rotary, spiral cyclic, progressive, second ray. But then he actually identifies spiral cyclic as related to the first ray, or at least the spiral part of it is related to the first ray. And cyclicity, I can't remember anymore. But he breaks them apart. He breaks them apart.
Probably the key aspects are in each of them. Probably the three aspects have to be in each of them.
Because even this progress onward is done this way.
Right.
You know, it's like a corkscrew. Yeah, I see. Yeah.
And the simplest of that would be the atom, the proton, neutron, the electron, in that rotation.
Yeah.
You have these three aspects. And an atom is rotating.
Certainly. Yeah. Well, you know, this whole principle of repetition without going anywhere is really the third ray. You know, over and over again, it's just the lunar part of our nature that just has inertia. It just wants to keep on being what it is. But the minute you give it a little, you know, that little thing is the first ray, you know, the first ray, then the second ray is born. You see how out of motion the second ray is born? Because round and around plus straight ahead induces the gradual rising, which is the second ray. But there's other weird things he does as he names the types of motion. And I wrote about it in a detailed, clear manner, but it slips my mind. All right. Vibration, the effect of divine activity, as has been discussed, is twofold. There is the first effect in which the vibration issuing from the realm of subjectivity in response to sound and light produces response in matter. So this is how he considers vibration. Issuing from the realm of subjectivity and in response to sound and light produces response in matter and therefore attracts or calls together the atoms out of which molecules, cells, organisms, and finally integrated form can be built. So vibration induces attraction. I think he's saying that. Okay. This effected, the aspect of vibration is to be noted as a duality. Do you get that?
No.
The form through the medium of the five senses becomes aware of the vibe. Maybe he's going to go on and explain that. Because he says, vibration and form are inseparable. Vibration is the effect of divine activity, and it's twofold. First, the effect in which vibration produces a response. So the very first thing is vibration produces a response in matter, and therefore attracts matter into units. Okay, now, you know, of course, that's not just an obvious statement, because why would a response attract, except a response is probably a differentiated response, which has its harmonies and inharmonies, its resonances. And so if you differentiate, you set up a field of attraction. between likes and a field of repulsion between dislikes or unlikes. That's one possibility. Anyway, let's not worry about it. Let's go on. The form through the medium of the five senses becomes aware of the vibratory aspect of all forms in the environment wherein it itself is a functioning entity. So awareness and then probably attraction or repulsion. At least we know that awareness or touch is followed by attraction or repulsion. And thus, formal differentiation. In other words, if like attracts like, certain forms are built. And other things, and those forms are built because certain possibilities of forms are negated through repulsion. Things are repelled and then attracted elsewhere, and other forms are built. So we have a differentiation of various forms arising through attraction and repulsion. Okay. Touch, strange words. Okay. Repulsion. Something to do with poultry. Sorry. Lunch. Okay.
Okay, and go up the page, you have one more typo on top. Just one more.
Notice how he said just one more. It's just to set me at ease.
Yeah.
Just one more typo. Okay. Ah, Lynn, just in the nick of time. But awareness of touch is followed by attraction or repulsion and thus formal differentiation. Okay, I'll go back there later. Later in time and space, that functioning form becomes increasingly aware of its own inner vibration.
Interior
vibration. And by tracing back that vibration to its original source, becomes aware of the self and later the kingdom of the self. So first outer vibration, and form building, and then inner vibration, and reuniting with self. First outer vibration and form building, and then inner vibration and the reunion with the reality or self within. Humanity as a whole is aware of its environment, and through the information conveyed by the sense of light, hearing, touch, taste, and smell, the phenomenal world, the outer garment of God, is known, and communication between the self and what we call the natural world is set up. As the mind appropriates and synthesizes this knowledge, the dweller in the form passes through the following stages. Vibration is registered, and the environment has its effect upon the form. The effect is noted but not understood. The man, under the slow and steady impact of this vibratory effect, slowly awakens to consciousness or awareness. The environment begins to interest the man, and he regards it as desirable. This is good. Steadily, the attraction of the three worlds grows and holds the man in reiterated incarnation. The word reiterated is literally and more academically correct than repeated, because it's not exactly a repetition. It's not the same. It's another instantiation, it's another instance, but is different from the earlier.
Iteration is there's a change made, and therefore it's different, and that's an iteration.
Iteration has a change in the repeated instance.
It also has a connotation of speech, doesn't it? Iteration, when you iterate something.
Yeah, reiterate and iteration. It's a term used in philosophy many times. It's like another instance of, though slightly different, perhaps. Yeah, another. Like each new universe is an iteration, or maybe a reiteration, but not a repetition. Right, okay, that's it. Yeah, same. Each new universe is a reiteration. I think I'll understand that. And there's a new word, too. I know you want to break. Each of us is really a reiterated word sounding in time and space. We're just going to finish this last little bit. well, no. I mean, all right. I'll tell you what. If you think you can pick it up here.
Yeah.
And your mind will not lapse, and you will not forget what we've just said, yeah. as I have just forgotten.
The food is very hot. It might be good to let it cool.
Well, you can always tell. You can always tell when you if you said something that's really appealing. Yeah. All right, well, we'll... Some like it hot. All right, we'll let it go. We'll let it go now. We'll come into this sequence after lunch. Okay. We've only been going for 2 hours and 50 minutes, no wonder.